Welcome everyone to the Genetics Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today with Lord James O'Shaughnessy, who is a member of the House of Lords here in the UK and senior partner at New Market Strategy. I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation today where we're going to talk really about policy and how do we go and take the science that many of you listening to this are doing on a day-to-day basis and actually make it easier for it to have an impact? How do we better fund it? How do we make places like the UK, where James is based, or any country to actually make better use of the incredible scientific talent and resources like data, for example, that we have? So it's going to be a great conversation, I think, and one that we really haven't had on this podcast before, that I've been meaning to have for a while. And when I read James's review of the clinical trial landscape in the UK that was commissioned by the government, I thought it would be a really good opportunity to have this conversation. And he's also written a really great piece in Wired looking at the UK and how it could be a better place to do life sciences research and have a bigger impact that we'll link to in the show notes. So that's some of the background here. But James, I just want to say thank you for taking the time, and I'm really looking forward to it.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So as we talked about in the pre-call chat, you're not a scientist by background, but you've done a lot of, I think, really important work looking at how science is better done and can be more impactful in places like the UK. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how you got interested in this in the first place. And for those who aren't familiar with the structure in the UK, maybe demystify a little bit the different houses and what people do, right, and the kind of roles that you've held in the past.
Yeah, no. So I'm a policymaker, is how I describe myself at heart. And what that meant was spending, you know, 20 years in one form or another, helping to make policy in various areas, mainly in public services, really, in sort of domestic economic issues. So I started off as a junior researcher in looking at pensions and benefits, social security. I was then actually involved in education, particularly school reform, for a long time. I helped design and implement the UK government's free school and academy program, which for people listening in the US is like charter schools, and for people listening in Sweden is free schools, which is where we got the name from. And I was a director of policy for David Cameron in the Conservative Party in opposition, and then when we came into government in 2010, took that similar role, director of policy in number 10 Downing Street, working to the Prime Minister, and then left, became a social entrepreneur, actually went out and set up some schools myself, set up an academy trust with a big focus on character education, and then got appointed to the House of Lords. And I'll come back and explain what that is in a minute. All set, maybe with hopes of becoming an education minister one day, perhaps, given that's actually the subject I knew about. And I was asked to become a health minister. And so it was a bit of I describe it as a sort of happy handbrake turn in my career, where I got to thrown in the deep end, but with this portfolio as a junior minister, which included the life sciences, medicine, medical devices, regulation, digital technology, like basically all the fun and interesting stuff, I think, yes, in healthcare. I didn't have to worry about workforce plans and new buildings and let alone strikes and waiting lists and all that kind of stuff. So all the jazzy stuff, including, you know, I chaired the National Genomics Board and various other things. So it was just one of those opportunities where you kind of dive deep, you get the opportunity to really to speak to anybody you want to, you know, world-leading academics, entrepreneurs and others. And you know, who wouldn't get excited by that? I guess what the kind of bit that stuck with me is that I could see that so much good innovation was not ultimately reaching the people who are going to benefit from it, either by design, because systems can't bear the cost, or by accident, because they're badly designed. And so that is what kind of stuck with me, right? Is how we can unblock that in a way that is sustainable for health systems who have to pay for these innovations, but which brings benefits to patients, of course, because they live longer, healthier lives, but also works for the economy because you've got more investment, more jobs, more growth, and so on, right? So that is pretty much what I've been working on in one form or another ever since.
What was that like, taking that handbrake turn and going into all of those areas you described are immensely challenging to get even up to speed a little bit, let alone be in one of the driver's seats to help make some of these major policy decisions? How do you learn about a new area like that when you're probably under immense pressure?
Yeah, honestly, it was fun. It was challenging, but it was really fun. In fact, I think on my third day in the job, I had to go and answer questions in the House of Lords on like three different topics. It was like that was there for 45 minutes. I had reams of briefing paper, but you just have to, you know, back your judgment and rely on the opinions of people who know more than you. And that was really it. You know, again, one of the beauties of being a minister is if there's something you don't know about, you can get your office to call someone up who really is like a world expert, and they'll come along and explain it to you. So that, you know, I mean, what a privilege, right? As well as talking to, you know, patients, clinicians, going on visits, that kind of thing. So if you've got the appetite, you can learn pretty quickly. And I think also just be clear what I don't do. Like, I'm not a scientist, you know, I'm a policymaker. So my job is to think about how policy can help scientists, innovators, and so on. It's not to try and be one, right? So as long as you know what your limits are as well, I think it's important. And just because I said I'd come back to it, what is the House of Lords? Yeah, in the UK, we've got what's called a bicameral parliamentary system. So two chambers, one of which is elected, that's the House of Commons, one of which is these days appointed, but which used to be hereditary. Hence, we've all got titles like Lord and this, yes, that, and Baroness and this, that, and the other. Unfortunately, when you get appointed these days, you don't get like a packet of land, a castle, and various other things like happen in the good old days. So it tends to be people who are expert in, you know, one field or another who are appointed and have an advisory role, but ultimately not a sort of definitive role in legislation and so on.
Yeah, and you do go in, and because I'm American, but I've lived in the UK for 10 years now, and you hold sessions and you debate and you discuss in the way that Americans, for example, or other parliamentary systems might be used to, right? So it's really interesting. I mean,
again, really early on in my time as a minister, somebody said to me, somebody who had been like a cabinet minister back in the day, said, you know, when you stand up, the thing you have to remember is that whatever subject you're speaking on, somebody in here has written a book about it.
Right.
So, oh my God. Okay.
Good. Perfect.
Thanks. Yeah. That's really ratcheting up the tension. But that's a great thing, right? So, I mean, there is almost no topic under the sun that you couldn't find someone who's genuinely expert in it in the House of Lords. It's lots of other things that are kind of slightly odd and unusual about the design of it as a chamber. But when it comes to that sort of thing, it's pretty good.
Yeah. So at the time when you were in the ministerial position, what were the biggest challenges of the day? And what do you think you made a huge amount of progress on? What are the ones that are still kind of troubling you today that we haven't made quite as much progress in all these years?
How long have you got? I think the ultimate mission of accelerating innovation is always going to be a work in progress. And you know, we made, I think, what are some of the things I'm sort of proudest of? We made real progress on elimination of Hep C. Hepatitis C was able to kind of really accelerate the ambition of that program, which I know has saved hundreds, if not thousands, of lives, which is a pretty amazing thing to be part of. And there's probably a handful of things in that area. I mentioned the National Genomics Board. When I was there, we were pivoting away from 100,000 genomes project, effectively a research project, to the ambition of sequencing 5 million genomes and taking genomics out of the lab and into medicine, you know, frontline medicine, which the UK, I think, has done incredibly well in rare diseases. It's still working out how to do it best in cancer, but we're moving that direction. We're still a world leader. So very proud of that. We instigated a big review on medicine and medical device safety because there were like a handful of scandals, all of which showed up similar flaws in the system. Not least, the system is really bad at listening to women, which is sort of interesting, and that's produced some change. And I was also the lead minister responsible for navigating the health and care system through Brexit.
Right. What was that like?
That was interesting. Trying to work out if there was any middle path that we could take, you know, with our role with the EMA and that kind of thing. And also just things like really important but prosaic things like, have we got our medicine supply chain sorted? Yeah. And actually, I know this has come up in the COVID-19 inquiry here in the UK, but actually a lot of that work did help us in the pandemic, because for the first time, we'd actually mapped out our supply chains for all the, you know, thousands of medicines which are coming into the UK. So anyway, that was super interesting. I guess the other one would be the introduction of GDPR, data protection, you know, New Data Protection Act in healthcare, which has obviously had quite a profound effect across the economy as a whole, but particularly when it comes to health data.
Right. Well, and I remember when that was coming out, there were a lot of very valid concerns about how are we going to interpret some of these gray areas, right? The need to re-consent or not.
Yeah.
Consent is a double-edged sword, right? You want to have it and it needs to be proactive. But also, if you were to consent someone for absolutely everything, then they'd be inundated with requests. The UK Biobank has 10,000 odd researchers, right? So we acknowledge there's concept of broad consent. And I remember at the time GDPR really throwing this to the fore of researchers saying, look, if this is interpreted this way, this could be a massive problem and grind things to a halt, right?
Yeah. And actually, it was really interesting because, and it's a subject I then came back to with the clinical trials review, is we decided to introduce a single national data opt-out for patients at the same time as GDPR. And the reason for doing that, it sounds like a mad thing to do, instead of just having one hard thing to implement, let's do two on the same day. But the idea was, because we were going to, the government and the NHS was going to be advertising about the move to GDPR, it actually gave us a platform to talk about that creating a single opt-out, there used to be two. And to give, actually to raise the profile of the subject, so if you're something you're worried about, you have the option of opting out. We made it easy and we did lots of user research on the process and all the rest of it. What was interesting about it is the consequence of that is on net, more people opted back in than opted out. Again, at that time. So that left two thoughts in my mind. One was, oh, this is interesting. If you actually engage with people about this topic, which is fairly arcane and can be a bit complex, they kind of buy the argument that data contributes to research and research contributes to better care. And it is quite a complicated argument and you can't just assume people know it. But if you take the effort to engage them in it, generally speaking, you get a good response. So sort of that stayed with me. The second was, what an unbelievable missed opportunity to communicate with all those people, and all that we were asking them to do was to not opt out, i.e. we were asking them to do nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of saying, where you went onto the landing page, instead of saying, here's what you need to do if you want to opt out, we could have had a button next to it that said, and if you want to be part of a research cohort, which we've now done with in the UK with something called Be Part of Research, which is a cohort study. It's got over 400,000 people now in it. You can sign up through the NHS app. We didn't do any of that. So we were kind of all that effort to get people to do nothing rather than to be part of something, right? Which kind of speaks to quite a cautious attitude on these subjects and not wanting to push it. So those two things really stayed with me and they kind of popped up again in the clinical trials review, which I guess we'll talk a bit more about.
Yeah, let's go there right now. I'm curious about what does the process look like to actually get selected and chosen to do that sort of thing? Where does the idea initiate of we've got a problem with clinical trials and someone needs to take a look at this and open up the hood, and then how did you get picked to lead that? And then
I don't know how many people said no before I said yes. So the first thing is you don't instigate these kind of reviews if everything's going fine. So the first thing is, obviously clinical trial activity, particularly commercial clinical trial activity, had been on a kind of 5-year downward trend, notwithstanding what happened in COVID, which is, I describe it as a mixed blessing, because on the one hand, UK genuinely world leading in COVID therapeutic and vaccine trials. On the other hand, lots of stuff was paused with very significant consequences. But actually the trend started before that, multifactorial. So first of all, there was a problem and everyone understood it. Secondly, I think they wanted somebody external who could take a look at it, somebody who knew enough, but not too much, which is definitely how I'd put myself in that category. I know more now, but I knew just enough that the questions I asked weren't totally stupid. Like I knew what a clinical trial was, but not so much that they came in with very strong priors about what should happen, which I think meant that I could listen intelligently, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I think, obviously it was felt that I was a candidate for that. I mean, it's chosen by ministers ultimately, and number 10, they have to sign these things off. They wanted to do a review. They wanted somebody who they felt would do it well and be credible. Luckily, they thought of me. And so that's how it's happened. I mean, interestingly, I was actually first approached about it, I think, in summer 2022. And then there was quite a lot of challenges and chaos, shall we say, UK government, summer 22, autumn 22. So it didn't actually get, in the end, signed off by a different set of ministers until the end of 2022. And then we did it in the first half of 23.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was going to ask about the timeline, actually. That was faster than I expect, because it's a pretty big topic to dive into and get answers. Maybe you could talk about I think you named one of the headline problems, which you could see for 5 years, that clinical trials were declining in the UK. Yeah. But what did you find as the reasons why? And what are some of the things that either are already happening or could be happening to right the ship?
So firstly, just a bit about process, because actually, like I said, in a funny sort of way, it was quite helpful that it took a bit longer than anticipated to set it up, because it meant that there was a sense of anticipation from industry, NHS, academia, policymakers and others. Once we had a go ahead, it was actually incredibly easy to get it going. And I got support from a brilliant woman called Emily Hirsch from the Office of Life Sciences and some of her colleagues. So we were able to get going quickly, very widespread engagement through online workshops, one-to-ones and so on, with different groups like industry, academia, NHS, policymakers, SMEs, others, CROs and so on. Really high levels of engagement, and everyone who contributed in one form or another is listed at the back, so I won't pick people out, but what hopefully people see is A, a lot of engagement, and B, actually probably really healthy weight of a private sector, because of course ultimately they're the customers, as well as contributions from patient groups who of course represent the beneficiaries. So in that sense, academia and the NHS for commercial trials are a kind of intermediary or service deliverer, you know, intermediating between the beneficiary and the sort of supplier. The other thing is worth saying is I thought early on the best way to frame it would be around problem statements, like not to try and sugarcoat things, just to tell things as they are. And I think that was the right thing to do, because, you know, if you're a minister, you probably have to like frame that as, oh, well, these are opportunities.
Right, right.
It's like, no, they're problems. We just need to recognize the problems and do something about them. There was actually a lot of alignment on what the problems were, broadly speaking, consensus, and a fair degree of consensus about what solutions might be needed, albeit, you know, I suppose that's where the creative element comes in as a kind of leader of one of these reviews, is you're trying to be creative in solutions. And also there are then a subset of people, half a dozen people, who were just genuinely did so much, like put so much into it as third parties, you know, just interested parties, entrepreneurial academics often. Who were finding it hard, who had actually done well or were doing well, but almost in spite of the system rather than because of it. They were sort of the system, but they were now almost fighting against it, who helped with some of the more kind of creative ideas. So I was incredibly lucky to be able to rely on them.
And I guess problem number one, maybe you'd put them in order, but was bureaucracy. And I'd love to actually just think about that or ask about that in the context of the almost like the purpose of the NHS. I think one of the things that I've seen as an American living in the UK for now almost 10 years is that the NHS is this amazing institution that almost by its amazingness ends up with a lot of constraints, because it's first and foremost for care, but it's such an opportunity for research and innovation. And often these things can come into tension. Sometimes there's great harmony. Yep. A clinical trial can be an amazing source of care, and very often it is. But when you think about something like whole genome sequencing and Genomics England, those become 10-year bets that don't really translate into care. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and the tension that you have between the NHS as the healthcare system versus an innovation engine at the same time.
Yeah. Great question. So I think I'm going to split that into two. So the primary kind of KPI for commercial trial sponsors is speed of approval by the regulators, and speed of setup, speed of recruitment of first and last patients in. And on all those things, the UK was performing really badly, right? So the first recommendations in the review were all about speed. And again, you can almost break that up into two. Which is around, the first is around the speed of approval by the regulator. So the performance of the MHRA as the main regulator had just dropped off a cliff, bunch of reasons. Actually, the other regulator that does the Research Ethic Committee approvals, the HRA, confusingly, was generally had like came out very well. People were really happy with it, but the MHRA was underperforming. So that was the first one. You've got the top-down bit. You've got to have speedy approvals, speedy protocol amendments, and so on. The second is the speed, but from the site level, like how easy is it to instigate a trial and recruit to it? And again, what we're finding is lots of duplication of setup paperwork almost. So it should be the case that if one NHS trust has done all the paperwork and is the lead site, that every other trust just accepts that as a matter of course, doesn't do its own due diligence, just bang, it's done. Not happening, wasn't happening. So so if you think about, that's all about speed, right? If you have do it once, do it for all, and you have a regulator that's performing at the level it should be or above, which would make it genuinely world-leading in turnaround times, then you can genuinely slash the time it takes and get it to somewhere like world-leading performance, which is places like the US and Spain and Australia and so on. So that was the biggest, in some ways, that's the biggest part of it. There's then a second issue, which is, okay, let's imagine you can do all of that really speedily. You've taken out all the unnecessary steps, it's still safe, it's legal, it's ethical, you're following the right processes. Is the NHS like capable of resourcing that kind of thing? Does it care about research culturally? And I think that is an ongoing challenge, right? Because the level of R&D in the NHS isn't as high as it should be for a healthcare system of its kind. Research is often seen as like a hobby that sits alongside day-to-day care. We have tremendous pressure, obviously, on day-to-day care, whether you measure elective waiting lists, primary care waiting times, ambulance waits, you know, whatever your metric. And of course, an aging population, all those sort of factors, right? So where do you find time to do research, and how do you create the right incentives on everybody in the system, from, you know, HCPs working in wards all the way up to kind of board level directors, so that they actually are incentivized professionally, financially, whatever it is, to care about research. Right? That is in some ways the hardest nut to crack. Now, I think it's the case that if you make research a hell of a lot easier to do, actually what I describe as the latent entrepreneurialism of those healthcare professionals comes through. And yeah, we have seen an increase, so almost doubling actually since the summer, of commercial trial activity, which tends to suggest that that might be a decent hypothesis. And I do believe it. So it's not that you're creating like dedicated time as such, you've just made reduce the barriers. I think there is still a work in progress about how to create those right incentives, so that, you know, your trust chief executive, the board, the head of R&D, actually they keep the money that they make from research. It gets reinvested into more research activity. You build out that capacity. The best do it, the best in class do it. If you go to Great Ormond Street, you know, on world's greatest children's hospital, their board looks at dashboards every month, and one of the metrics on that dashboard is what trial activity and what commercial trial activity and how much money it's bringing in. That is not ubiquitous.
Is that a cultural change, or is it a, you know, is it something that the leaders of every other institution would actually want to make the change, but there's something structural stopping them from doing it? Because in the US, you know, I'm interested, you probably know the data better, but anecdotally, I feel like every major institute that I know of and have interacted with, you've got that. You know, everybody's got two or three entrepreneurial side hustles, and and they make it work, right? And it's not the case that I can see over here.
Yeah, and look, I think we have to be careful about drawing parallels between the two health systems. They're so radically different.
Yeah.
So it's maybe more accurate to sort of look at mainland Europe, you know, social insurance systems, but much more similarities. And yet they still seem to find some of the right incentives. And if you look at countries that have gone from sort of nowhere in this space to actually doing a lot of work, and Spain is the one that everyone sort of points out in Europe, they've done it by just a kind of relentless attention and focus on putting in place all the elements that are required to do this. So I think it's, in their port, it's a mixture of structural and cultural.
Yeah.
It's not just about investment. Like if you, you know, you could go and invest in a clinical research facility in a hospital and it could just stand empty. Right. If you don't attend to all those other factors. And unfortunately, there's a reason there's 27 recommendations rather than five, is that it's not, you know, there's no silver bullets. There's a bunch of stuff that you have to do at once.
Yeah. What is it that Spain does so well? I mean, are there a couple of pillar or lighthouse things that they've really gotten right that the UK could pick up on, or other countries?
Speed. They went for speed. I mean, quality, sure. And I think the other thing is access to data. One of the bits of feedback we had during the review was that the UK is always talking, you know, so the UK has an amazing science base, definitely. Everyone agrees on that. We do brilliantly in early phase trials, which is, again, kind of what you'd expect with a great science base. The closer you get to both healthcare adoption and commercialization, our performance tails off. So, you know, we can definitely big up our science base, but we need to attend to that sort of later phase trials and kind of adoption and innovation in the NHS. And the other is, feedback we heard in some cases really quite bluntly from drug companies was, you guys are always telling us about how good your data is, but we can never get it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think about getting hold of data, what do you mean by that? Well, it's a bunch of things, isn't it? It's like legal frameworks, it's technical issues if some of this stuff is not federated or interoperable.
Yeah.
It's also the trust issue. And again, I'm not a data scientist. I'm not a scientist of any point, as I said, but thinking as a policymaker, all these things, ultimately, the technical problems and even legal problems are always solvable.
Yeah.
But the issue of trust is one that is, you never solve it, right? It's an ongoing thing that you have to do. So coming all the way back to that experience in May 2018 and thinking about GDPR and an opt-out and so on, you have to lead people through a rationale and a process whereby they get to consider what's at stake, the cost, the benefits, what you might put in to mitigate risk, the opportunities, and so on. And then generally speaking, whenever these exercises happen, they come up with an answer, which is, actually, you've got to use this data for good. And there are some guardrails that you can't, you know, go outside of, sort of thing that vast majority of people, even perhaps the more radical exponents of this, wouldn't disagree with. And you've got to show that you're aligning with the values of the health system. Fine, totally fine. But you can't take it for granted. And so one of my recommendations is, and this is something that NHS England is working on at the moment in England, which is obviously only one of four countries of the UK, but nevertheless, it's the biggest one, it is actually doing that at regional level as well as local and national level, so that we have, as it were, that reassurance that there is an ongoing attempt to build trust. And it's not that thing where you just like classic government consultation, we're going to do this anyway, and then we're going to give you 4 weeks to tell us what you think about it, right, and then ignore it. It's actually getting in at the beginning and giving genuine guidance and deliberation and decision making into the public, which is a slightly scary thing for policymakers to do. They don't generally like doing it because they feel like they lose control. But my view is you've got control over nothing if you haven't asked them, the public, for permission. So you should.
Yeah. And you'll do all this work for something that is ultimately rejected. Right. And then you've really lost control.
And this is what's happened, right? You know, there's been a handful of really good examples of when this has gone badly, and you've got loads of people opting out of exercising that national data opt-out, which I mentioned, which then just harms the quality of the asset. So yeah, so that's the cost.
Yeah. And I was interested to think about the path towards a, you know, the if you call it UK as the healthcare data utopia, that if we think about something like the UK Biobank, they've done an amazing job at combining genomic imaging, other kinds of omics, healthcare data. Although I spoke to Professor Rory Collins very early on in the podcast, and he made the point that it was very difficult for them to get access to primary care GP data.
Yep.
And as I think you've written about before, they were able to use some emergency legislation during COVID to get access to it, but it was not a permanent solution. And you know, I think you painted in your Wired piece a pretty succinct example of what this could look like. You're talking about integration of deep phenotyping, healthcare data, presumably across from primary through to tertiary, other kinds of more advanced technologies, genomics, and so on. But getting there requires this trust element. It also requires some technological systems. What do you think has to happen in the UK to have a chance at getting to something like that in this decade, say? Is it going to happen with our future health and Genomics England and what's happening now? Or is there some ingredient that's missing to really get it on a national scale in the way that would really unlock some amazing things?
It's a great question. So I think there possibly are a few small technological barriers, but which I think are being overcome in terms of federated data analytics and approaches to that. So there probably is still a bit of innovation required, but ultimately it comes down to three things, one of which is money. You know, infrastructure spending. It's all very well having the technology. You've actually got to pay for the technology and extend it to all this data. And then the second two things are about people. The first is clinicians. So it's obvious that researchers want to use this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also got to work for clinicians. They've got to feel that this is the ongoing collection, analysis and use of data, or collection, curation, analysis and use of data has got to be in their interest rather than yet another thing that's being done for them. So how does that produce actionable insights that actually improve their care? And then, of course, you've got to have the same argument, essentially, you know what I mean? You've got to have the same conviction among patients that it is going to improve their care, and that it is okay, like it is, to the extent that there are any risks. I'm not sure there really are any risks, but to the extent that there are any perceived risks in data being used in that way, that is for their good, the good of their family, the good of the health system, and so on. So it's not, I don't think it's now a sort of technical problem as such, but it attends to those factors. I mean, it's interesting you raised that point about the emergency legislation, because of course what that did is it overrode existing data protection and common law duty of confidentiality objections because of a public health emergency during COVID. Does anyone object to the fact that that was done and that was used to inform, you know, vaccination policy, which actually meant that the UK was the one that was extending the gap between the first and second Pfizer vaccines, which, by the way, has saved billions of pounds and thousands, tens of thousands of lives? Yeah. No. And, you know, there's any number of other use cases for the way that data was done. So is there a case for kind of having a peacetime version of they call the technical terms COPI notices, right? Confidentiality of patient information notices. Well, do we lack health emergencies? Not really. We've got, in the UK,
6,000 rare diseases without much options, right?
Right. And, you know, 250,000 people dying of cancer each year. And, they abound. Conditions which are amenable to treatment, dementia being, you know, a sort of exciting new frontier, for example. So could you imagine a version of that, which perhaps relied on different legislation because it is based around, you know, like true kind of public emergencies, if you like, but which nevertheless captures the spirit of that in the service of these big killers. and done in a way which actually that is guided by the public rather than guided by, you know, the sort of top from the top down. That seems to me completely plausible. And to build use cases, so maybe you don't have it just applying to anything, but you say if we're doing it, as you said, to try and find cures for rare disease, killing, you know, rare disease killers for which there are currently no treatments, nobody's going to object to that. Yeah. If you did it for dementia actually is quite an interesting edge case because there's lots of complexities with it given the nature of the disease and how it affects people. But it would be interesting to know what if there was a kind of public appetite and so on and so forth. I don't mean that this is something that public are wandering around thinking about how their data can be used for these things. Of course they're not. But when you engage the public, and I would encourage anybody to go and look at some of these public deliberations and their outcomes, it's really interesting how people think about them. And they often start off quite cynical about what's going on here. And then they come to the conclusion that this is like an amazing asset that we have to use.
Yeah.
So I think something along those lines which said, you know what, actually, here are five disease areas or whatever it is that we can and need to do something about. Our data can help. And let's kind of have that same spirit, pandemic spirit, and apply it to those.
Yeah, completely agree. It seems like, you know, the core ingredient is that trust and transparency, where if you say, we're going to use your data for all these things and not tell you about it, then that's a big problem with everybody. But if you say, we're going to be really proactive in disclosing the kind of work that's going on, and like you said, it's for important things, it completely flips, right? And people say, actually, it's a problem that my data isn't being used to solve cancer and rare diseases. It becomes a moral imperative to do it rather than not do it. And of course, you have to do it responsibly. But I couldn't agree more. I mean, from all the work we've done with engaging with patients and caregivers and other interested people, it tends to be more about, you know, you have to get the table stakes of privacy and transparency correct. Yep. But after that, actually, it's, you know, we should be using it as effectively as we can. We've been maybe negative isn't the word. The UK is an amazing place to do science and for healthcare as well. And obviously, we're being negative only because the potential is so great that there are things to fix. But I'm curious what other countries can learn from the UK, in your view. What are the big things that we've gotten right here?
Yeah, and look, I suppose what we've been doing is setting a scene for the problem so that we can kind of focus on the solutions, right? Yeah. And the fact is that, you know, even in 6-9 months in commercial trials, which is obviously only one segment of all trials and one part of the life science ecosystem, we've managed to kind of turn the tank around pretty quickly and things are getting better. And of course, we need to sustain that attention and keep going. But yeah, it just goes to show these things are amenable. And of course, what's good about that is it suggests that there is still really strong demand from commercial sponsors to want to be here because of our strong science base, because of the ability to access genomic data, because of those data assets that we've been talking about and so on. So I'm very optimistic, actually. So the way I think of talk about these kind of commercial trials is they're of sort of outsized importance because they bring together lots of different elements of the life science ecosystem. And if it's not working, it's sort of a sign that things aren't really working across the ecosystem. If they are working, it's a sense that everyone's kind of aligned on purpose. And of course, the beauty of them is they bring extra money into the country, as well as bearing in mind most of them are kind of late stage trials. By this point, you know, the drugs work. It's just about effect sizes. So you're bringing innovative medicines to people earlier, right? So there's a lot of reasons to care about it. And as I said, you know, I set this kind of ambition in a review of doubling and then doubling again our clinical trials activity. Well, we've done the first doubling in 9 months. Let's keep going, right? I think we can be incredibly ambitious on it. And then there's the sort of the innovation, this sort of, well, that's great. And that's doing the trials that we do today. What about the trials of tomorrow? What about decentralized trials? Okay, well, we've got amazing primary care assets here. Our primary care data is actually the best, probably the best data of its kind in the world, longitudinal, totally digitized, 20 years old, you know, 20 years of data and so on. How do we use that? Not only to bring trials closer to people, to increase diversity of trial participants, but actually to create more income streams and more research and so on happening for GPs, which is obviously going to be good for them. At the other end of the spectrum, precision medicine, the promise of sort of N1 trials, we have so much of that capability because of the investments in genomics and so on for truly personalized medicine. So we can be a leader in that regard. We've obviously got a very strong AI industry, which has a lot to contribute to trial innovation. So I'm genuinely optimistic about what's possible in all of those domains. I think the thing that we always have to keep working on, and we talked about the sort of public trust thing a lot, so I won't tell you about that, but is making sure that research feels fundamental to the purpose of the health system rather than just something it does on the side.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that it is genuinely foundational. And I think that, you know, it's an easy thing to say, and it's a difficult thing to do for a system that's under tremendous pressure. But of course, the only way you get out of that pressure is through productivity gain. The only way you get productivity gains is through innovation. And the only way you get innovation typically is through R&D. So it is actually the only route out of it, but we just need it to make it easier to access for the health system to do more R&D.
There's a common refrain that you always hear about health systems, not just in the UK, but pretty much everywhere in the world, that if you have some kind of vertically integrated or cradle to grave type of system like we have in the UK, that at least in theory, what you said holds true, right? We need to invest in innovation. And if it takes 10 years, but it's, you know, pays for itself in that time and beyond, then it's worth doing. You know, you think about prevention. But, yeah. You know, the common refrain is we have this 1-2 year budget crunch that we're up against. And so you have that long-term reality, which is probably true, but you have the short-term that I actually can't do anything that doesn't save me money this year. How, to what extent is that true? People say that a lot, but I don't see the P&Ls of NHS Trust. is that the case? Or, you know, to what extent is that fact or fiction that we can't innovate because we literally don't have enough money this year?
So that is a, that's a really difficult question to unpack. I think one of the observations I'd make about the health system is, I mean, you talked about it being vertically integrated, but part of the problem is it's not. So secondary care and primary care are funded differently. Mental health and community trusts are funded differently. Public health is funded differently. And they're all meant to work nicely with one another, but they don't always. And one of the problems you have historically is the problem that positive externalities of intervention in one of those layers,
right,
land in another layer and literally aren't accounted for either in, you know, sort of conceptually or financially, you know, in accounting terms, within the layer of the health system that actually makes the intervention. So you could have an intervention that, you know, somebody goes to a pharmacist and that the consequence of paying, you know, £2 for to check their heart rate means that you spot early that they've got a cardiac arrhythmia and so on, and you can intervene in them and so on. You save a bunch of money because they don't end up having a heart attack. But who pays for that £2? Well, I mean, it's obvious it works for the system. And we have in NICE, we have an agency which is meant to work out the ROI on these kind of interventions, and it can say that it's the right thing to do, and it can even sort of fund these things or quasi-mandate them. But ultimately, if that pharmacist doesn't have access to £2, I mean, I'm being, you know, extreme in my characterization, but it could be any number, then it won't happen. And so, but the hospital will end up just having to foot the cost. So you've got problems like that positive externality problem arising elsewhere and works in reverse, the negative externalities, right, of not taking action. So that's been a real problem. Now, the advent of integrated care systems in the UK are meant to address that so that it makes sense for the hospital to spend money in the pharmacist or the GP surgery to prevent them having to spend money on, you know, an acute episode by preventing it, because you will have whole system, whole population accounting. That's one of the theories of it, right? So we're not there yet because it's all still quite nascent, but that is meant to be the idea. In reality, of course, all these elements are businesses of one form or another, and they might be public sector businesses like foundation trusts, or they might be private sector businesses like pharmacists or even GP surgeries. But nevertheless, all businesses think about their bottom line. And one of the challenges is, or of moving to preventive health, is you've effectively got to persuade hospitals to become smaller by spending more money upstream in preventive health. That is not how most institutions behave.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there are all sorts of, you can see what some of the sort of very interesting kind of almost sociocultural economic barriers are, even though everyone agrees it's the right thing to do. And even if you could create more money, carve out more money to do it, would it necessarily get spent in that way, or would it just get spent on the traditional way? So I think it is a bit about money, of course, and the availability of what you might call kind of transformation funding, whatever. But it is also about the kind of basic incentives that the institutions and the system have.
Yeah, and that makes sense. So you've got that. That's a great way to think about it. You have this positive, negative externality problem. I suppose that there's also a time element, right? I'm thinking about things like genomics and gene therapies, where you say, yeah, maybe it makes sense to spend £1 million this year, and we will see the benefit over this child's life. But, you know, there's in-year accounting. How far out do these models go? I mean, is someone accountable for a 10-year plan? It's hard to imagine because they may not even be in the job in 10 years, right?
So yeah, no, I think that's spot on. You know, most NHS trusts are on one-year budgets. They've got to make things add up year to year. And so you've got something of a gap between sort of early stage R&D, basic science, which is sort of taking a very long view with the expectation of lots of failure. And right at the other end, you've got organizations delivering healthcare with a one-year view where failure it's too common, but I mean, it's like completely unacceptable. But actually, there's something in the middle, that translational space, where you need to take a long view in order to get ROI, but you also therefore need some sort of working capital, as it were, to do that. And that tends to be the bit that gets squeezed.
Yeah, that makes total sense. So I suppose the pressure is on the innovator for finding things that don't just save money in 10 years, but do it now. And maybe, you know, in the gene therapy case, some companies are essentially taking installment payments, right? So there are some ways for businesses to solve that too, right? If you believe in your medicine, then you take the payment over 10 years rather than in year one.
Yeah, and look, I think medicines are in an unusual position compared to almost everything else, because in almost every country in the world, you've got statutory reimbursement. So if you pass, you get over the test thresholds of, you know, health economic thresholds of ROI, and assuming you've got your license and everything, you will get reimbursed. So even though you cost the system more money, you generate value. In the UK, at any rate, nothing else fits, like no devices, diagnostics, digital, nothing else fits in that category. So they all ultimately have to either have an incredibly compelling value proposition, so it's worth spending the money because the ROI is great, or they save money. But that is a very high barrier to get over. Like that in-year savings of any installation of any kind of technology is hard, right? Yes. Or else everyone would be doing it.
Yeah, that's right. We've only got 3 or 4 minutes left here. I want to just ask a really broad question to finish up, which was, any other observations you have about health data, health or research policy that are top of your mind right now? It seems like you were very busy in 2023 working on this review, certainly for the first half, but what's on your mind now? What are you thinking about and focused on?
Well, I think it does come back to that point, the thing that hooked me when I became a minister and has, you know, continued to hook me, which is that sort of innovation uptake thing, particularly for the UK, right? So if you wanted to characterize the UK, we've got a great basic science, we've got a very creative economy and a good tech sector. We've got pretty good access to sort of R&D funding, even to early stage venture capital. But where we struggle is on sort of scale-ups, and we struggle it both in a sense in healthcare, I mean, both in a sense of companies who go from having deployments in a handful of trusts to, I talk about going from the, you know, the one to few to some to many to all.
Yeah,
it's the last bit of that we struggle with. And simultaneously in the wider economy, we don't have access to the same amount of growth capital that would enable businesses to stay here. So they often go to the States, right? So we suffer on both counts. We suffer because we don't make the most of earlier stage innovation, whether it's homegrown or it comes here from other countries. And for those businesses that are homegrown, we struggle to keep hold of them as their ambitions grow and their, you know, their need and desire to generate really strong income and returns for their investors. Like, that's just bad for patients and it's bad for the UK PLC. Now, you can't boil the ocean, right? You can't suddenly turn us into a totally different economy. But can you incrementally improve that situation? Can you find ways to accelerate the uptake of innovation so it reaches more people in a way that's sustainable financially and actually does deliver ultimately better value and even saves costs, makes care more preventative? And can you that in itself would provide an incentive for businesses to stay here longer? And can we liberate some of the financial restraints that stop them growing or reaching their potential by staying in the UK for longer? You know, ultimately, yeah, for lots of companies, the States is the ultimate destination. You know, it's where global pharma makes 50% of its revenue and so on. So that's just an inevitability, but it's almost kind of keeping them here for as long as possible before the inevitable call across the Atlantic. I mean, I'm sort of, you know, simplifying obviously for effect, but you kind of understand what I mean. So that is what we continue to focus on. That's what we work on as the business at New Market Strategy is trying to find those go-to-market strategies, access to finance, partners, strategic partnerships, and so on that mean that UK PLC gets more out of these innovations than it might otherwise do.
Amazing. Well, this was an amazing conversation. I just want to shout out if people want to follow you or learn more about you. You're on Twitter as, I guess we got to call it X now, as James Osh, right?
Yes, but I never tweet anymore because for reasons I could go into another time, I'm an observer. But LinkedIn I do a lot on. So
okay, great. So they can add you on LinkedIn. And your website is newmarket-strategy.com. Well, thank you. I really appreciate this. I learned a ton. And yeah, I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
And thanks everybody for listening to the podcast. As always, we really appreciate you sharing with a friend if you liked it. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.